listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We have another chapter in our book, Day 7 for Work, Rest, or Play, by Dr. Joel Bierman. We'll get to that in just a moment. Today's episode of The Coffee Hour is underwritten in part by Concordia University St. Paul. You can learn more about Concordia University St. Paul at csp.edu. Joining us again, Dr. Joel Bierman, author of Day 7 for Work, Rest, or Play. Thanks for joining us again.
It's good to be here.
Today we get to talk about the receptive life.
Yep.
This is a very interesting chapter, interesting conversation. We got to talk about culture first, to lay some groundwork of our culture and what the state of our culture is. So what is the state of our Western culture? You talk a lot about Orwell and Huxley. So we got to like define some terms here.
Yeah, culture matters. And we are living right smack in the middle of it. Most of us don't pay a lot of time thinking about it, spend a lot of time thinking about it. We're just kind of there. We don't pay attention to the reality around us. But part of what we do in theology, in my world of systematic theology, is taking God's truth, which does not change. It's there, solid and certain. And we apply it to the world we're living in, which is always changing and always moving around. And the world we're living in is not like Luther's. It's not like St. Paul's. It's not like it was in Aquinas' day. It's not like it was in Walter's day, or even Pieper's day. The world is always moving. And so that's the idea of the culture. So paying attention to culture matters. The cultural moment we're living in is a complex one. Obviously, there's lots of stuff going on, and there's different ways of looking at it. One of the terms that has been used quite a bit, which I think works well, is the idea of living in a world of normal nihilism. And so nihilism is the idea that there's nothing. And we conjure up ideas of people wearing all black and, you know, skinny mustaches and, you know, listening to weird poetry and, you know, the nihilist. And that's kind of a weird subset. But nihilism is basically the idea of the description of what can we be sure of? Not much. Mm. What's really out there?
What?
Oh, don't know. And it's kind of up to you. And this traces back to Nietzsche from 100 years ago. And Nietzsche died in 1900, 125 years ago now. And he was the one who coined this idea of nihilism, means you can't prove anything for sure. Mm. And so what's at the bottom of things? Nothing. That's nihilism. And why we call it normal nihilism is it's just become the way our world works. Everybody takes for granted. You can't prove it. Everybody's got their truth. Everybody's got their way of operating. These have just become standard things in the world we live in. And so we live in a world where things are kind of up for grabs all over the place. And that's kind of where you get the Huxley and Orwell stuff. Orwell paints the picture, you know, the dystopia of Big Brother overseeing everything. Huxley, and he does that in his 1984. Then Huxley comes with his Brave New World and paints a dystopian picture quite different. Everybody's just pursuing pleasure and everything's carefully orchestrated to maximize pleasure, and that's what it's all about. I would argue that we live in a Huxley world much more than an Orwell world, even though there are, you know, the top-down Big Brother stuff, but it's all about pleasure and all about just kind of living for the moment, making the most of things. The amplitude in living itself is the way Philip Reeve once put it. It was a crabby sociologist from the late 20th century. And so he had a lot of right insights. So I think that kind of captures the world we're living in. It's a very nihilistic world. People don't know what it's all about. They're not sure what it's all about. They look for a meaning wherever they can find it. And it's kind of up to them to find that meaning. That's sort of the world we're living in. Hedonism is a big part of it. The pursuing the pleasure, the pursuing whatever makes myself feel good. The therapeutic is another term that comes into play here, huge, that I live to be cared for. And so this can come into careful eating, now I sleep, getting enough sleep and, you know, caring for myself and getting all the pieces in place so that I can be the best me that I can be. And you hear this even among Christians, you know, I'm cultivating my own self-understanding and you're making me a better me. And that's part of the therapeutic, and that's part of our culture as well, trying to find something that creates meaning.
Sounds like my entire Instagram feed.
Yeah, indeed.
So what happens when we focus on the individual and when we remove meaning from the world?
Yeah, what happens is you're left with people who are left with this terrible burden of having to find meaning, how to create meaning. Peter Berger called this the heretical imperative, that you have no choice but to choose. You have to make decisions. And we're faced with all kinds of decisions. You know, what kind of car do I drive? Where do I live? Where should I go to school? Who should I marry? What should I wear today? which can of beans should I buy in the grocery store aisle? And you got gazillions of choices. You know, it's just overwhelming that we live in this contemporary world with all these choices. And that seems freeing, but the insight that a lot of people are having is, no, it's actually quite crushing, because you have to decide about everything. You have to even decide who you are. And now we have, not to bring in a whole nother red herring, but you have to choose your gender and figure out your sexuality. You know, you think you're a boy, but are you really? You better figure this out. And we have, you know, your gender clarification and all this kind of stuff. And it's just an enormous burden. You have to figure out who you are, what you're here for, what's going on. And the world offers no answers. This is the different thing about our culture. In Luther's day, everybody knew God, there's Satan, there's the church, and you find your existence in tune with those things. There are answers, and everybody takes them seriously. But there are always your heretics who push back, but by and large, everybody knows this is how it works. In our contemporary culture, what is it that's real? What can you be sure of? And all you've really got left is the individual is really important and happiness. But how do you get it? You're on your own. Go do your thing. That's a tremendous, overwhelming burden to be able to figure it out and make sure you're making the right choice. And did I choose right? Did I get the right can of beans? Did I make the right choice about my career? Did I marry the right person? Oh, man, you never know. And you're always, always wondering. That's the heretical imperative. That's normal nihilism.
Just talking about all that's making me anxious.
Yeah, but exactly.
Did I do everything right this morning before I came to work? I mean, that is a huge burden on mental health and
yes.
Just all of the anxiety and depression that we fight with. I mean, obviously, all of these choices are just...
There is a reason why mental health is becoming a big issue. There are a reason why suicide numbers go up, and it's all related.
Yeah.
Yep.
How did we get here in our culture? I mean, we're talking about Luther's time and our time.
Yeah.
There's a lot of time in between there, and I'm not a total scholar on changes in culture. How did we get here?
It's a long story, which I know nobody wants to hear, but it's the rise of what we call the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment really comes to full birth in the 17th century, 1650s, when René Descartes dies. And Descartes kind of becomes the figurehead for this, but he's not only one to blame, but he kind of captures a lot of this. And it was in motion, but it's essentially man deciding, I'm going to figure out what things matter from my perspective instead of taking somebody else's word for it. I'm not going to believe what the church tells me. I'm not going to believe what the experts tell me. I'm going to decide for myself. And that becomes the Enlightenment, with man at the center instead of God at the center. And then away we go. Mm-hmm. And so then it just takes a few centuries, and we become more and more confident in our ability to do everything. We've got technology. We've got cell phones. We've got CAT scans. We can cure things. We've got planes that can fly, you know, around the world. And we just mastered everything. And so we feel like we're confident. We've got all the answers, and science seems to be excelling. But science can't tell me why I'm here. Science can't tell me my purpose in life. And we kind of forgot that we need some moral foundations. We've left all those things behind, and now we find ourselves with great technology, with an emptiness of other things, and that's part of the Enlightenment culture. So yeah, it traces back to scholars like Descartes. Science plays into it. Technology plays into it. All of it feeds into this idea of, I'm the center of everything. It's up to me to decide, how am I going to do that?
And all that guessing that you were describing just a moment ago about, did I choose the right thing? Did I do the right thing?
Yeah.
Almost sounds superstitious to me.
The spirituality never quite leaves. It just comes back in other places. There's an interesting book called Strange Rites by a gal named Tara Isabella Burton. And she argues for what we live in now, as she calls, it's not a lack of religion. It's just new religions, a new kind of spirituality. And it's basically, she calls it remixed religion, where you take a little, I like a little of my church stuff because I like how hymns sound, but I like to do self-care. And so I'm going to really get into this kind of self-care life and really get me the best me I can be and make sure I have my Zen, you know, contemplation, meditation time. But I still like going to church. And you just have these weird blendings of things. And it's all about me making what makes me feel best work. And that, I think, captures things really nicely.
Well, humans have been doing that since the beginning of time.
They have been. She argues that with technology, the lack of an overall kind of gestalt that kind of guides everything, that's a kind of free-for-all with pluralism, makes it even more pronounced in the contemporary situation. Mm-hmm. And I think she's probably right.
Oh, okay. Next question. Where's God in all of this then?
Yeah. Well, God's God, and always been.
He's always he promises to be.
He's in charge. It's all his. And so then the question for us, though, in the church is, So what do we do with this? And this is where we start to get even more zeroed in on, well, we probably should be paying attention to the things that God has told us and the things that actually matter. And then realizing that we need to live in a world that's got a completely different approach to everything. And that impacts how we operate as well. See, one of the mistakes we make is we think that we can look at culture as an observer and like, oh, that culture does this. We're all part of it. We all live in this world. And even the church starts to operate and pick up clues from this. You know, how are we going to be make ourselves more relevant? How are we going to meet people's needs? You know, how do we make ourselves attractive? Those are weird kinds of questions. And they're weird, but we don't think they are because we're so used to them. We just, well, that's obviously what you got to do. Those are all part of nihilism. We're all part of the contemporary culture. No one was asking those questions on Luther's day. But we ask them all the time, like they're givens. So none of us are immune from the culture. So if we're going to be a part of the culture, and we have to be because we're living here, we have to think about how do we actively, deliberately make God the center of things? How do we function as a church in a way that operates this way? How do I function in my family and in my own thinking that I keep God at the center? He's the foundation. His word matters. It's not about me. This takes some deliberate, intentional work. We can't just kind of, it doesn't happen automatically. That's kind of the big point.
I feel like there's another series we need to do on culture, but that's not this episode. But that's okay. We have so much more to talk about with Dr. Joel Veerman. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
At Concordia University, Wisconsin, we believe you were created for a reason, to use your God-given gifts to help others, to live a life of self-sacrifice in a me-first world, to live a life that's uncommon. Whether you're taking one of 50-plus online programs or learning with us in person on the shores of Lake Michigan, you'll be equipped to make an uncommon impact. Learn more at cuw.edu. Concordia University, Wisconsin. Live uncommon.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We're talking with Dr. Joel Veerman, author of Day 7 for Work, Rest, or Play from Concordia Publishing House, talking about the receptive life. We're talking a lot about culture. So let's shift culture to actually finding our purpose and meaning in life. We touched on this a little bit before the break. Is finding meaning or purpose, is this something that we do, or is it something that we receive, or is it neither?
Yeah, this is the kind of the argument I would like to make. I think the church obviously makes this argument that you come into existence, you're born, you're created. You didn't choose this. No one consulted you. It's given to you as a reality. And that's not a bad way of thinking about our existence. We come into existence because someone else has chosen it. And we would argue it's God who's chosen us. We're here because he's decided. He gets to call the shots. And this is why everything starts to matter then. Well, if God has shown us what matters and has revealed to us the things that count, we should probably pay attention to that. And that's the whole point of the scripture and the understanding of the teaching of the churches. This is God's revelation to us. These things matter. These things tell me who I am, what I'm here for. And one of the things I've come to realize in my years of teaching and serving in the church is I think we undersell the significance of giving people meaning and purpose in life. This is a big deal. We have to talk about eternal salvation. You can have your sins forgiven and have this assurance of eternal life. Great, I agree. That's pretty cool. But knowing what it means to be human and what I'm here for and having a reason to get out of bed and not just wait for someday I'll die and go to heaven, but my life matters now because I'm here because God created me to be here. I'm here to accomplish his purposes. I'm here to live in tune with him and with others. That's awesome. We have answers to the things that matter. What does it mean to be human? What are you here for? What's the meaning of life? What's the purpose? Church has answers to all of that stuff. And these are things that the world craves desperately for answers. We've got them.
Yeah, Ephesians 5:10, right?
Yep.
We are God's workmanship.
Created in Christ.
To do the things he created.
Yeah, well, 2:10, you're thinking.
Oh, 2:10, sorry. Yeah. Did I say 5? I meant 2:10,
yes.
My bad.
Yes.
I meant 2:10, yes. Get your references right, Andy.
We don't do numbers.
No, it's Ephesians, and it's somewhere in there.
Ephesians, yes, right. Yes. How do we know what this meaning of
we
life is?
We know because God himself has told us. The creator who made me who I am has told me You belong to me. I'm yours. You're mine. We belong together because I'm your Father, your God and Father, and we know the meaning because God has revealed it to us. And we know this because Christ has come, and God, he has shown us the way of what it means to be human, and he's proven the truth of his message, being raised from the dead. This is what matters. The resurrection kind of sits at the center of a lot of this stuff. You think, well, what's that got to do with anything? Well, everything, because it validates the message of Christ. Mm-hmm. It validates all that he has done. And it shows us that this is what it looks like to be the human that we're created to be. Christ shows us this. So how do we know the meaning of life? We trust what God has shown us in his own son.
When we, as humans, reject that and come up with other ideas about why we exist.
Yeah.
What does that do to us?
Well, yeah. Well, not only is it an affront to God, and we're obviously sinning and not listening to him, but it leaves us out of whack. We're not lined up the way we're supposed to be. We're not living in tune. See, this gets into a whole other topic, but this is I'm also interested in. If the way that we live is God's will, and when we live according to the plan of the Creator, things tend to go well. When we live at odds with that plan, things tend not to go well. When you use a tool the way it's supposed to be used, it works pretty well. When you use it in a way it was intended to be used, it doesn't quite get the job done. And it's very similar to us as human beings, that God has created us to be humans. And when we live according to the plan, it works pretty well. And it feels kind of good. It just clicks. And when you resist it, it doesn't work real well. And so if you're trying to create your own meaning and thinking, well, I'm here to do X, Y, or Z, whatever the meaning is, it's not going to satisfy. It's just not going to click. And that's why you have a lot of people who are, you know, living in despair and anxiety and not having answers and are terrified and anxious about what's it all about. And they don't know.
Yeah. The example you gave earlier, if I realize that I'm created by a creator, then it makes sense to go to the creator for objective truth, to go to the creator for the truth. And what is my meaning? What is my purpose?
That's right.
What does it mean to be created?
That's right.
By God. But then there's this whole other, well, I'm sure there are lots of other ideas, but, you know, when we think about Darwin's theory and how humans were created, I mean, where does that just leaves you, like, with what kind of purpose?
That's
to evolve?
Yeah. See, this is the dirty thing about the Enlightenment, and what it gives you is it gives you nihilism, where there's absolutely nothing you can be sure of, and then you're left with, well, science will give us the answers. Well, science tells me I'm just a product of evolution, and I'm just a bunch of, you know, matter that kind of has cognition and awareness.
And I'm supposed to evolve to do better.
And so what's the purpose? And there isn't one.
Right.
There absolutely isn't one. And it's terrifying, but that's what you get. Yeah. And it was also interesting is Darwin's whole project was, you know, we got to explain these problems, like, you know, why things work the way they work. And we don't want to have to just rely on old pat answers that the church gave us. And so in a sense, Darwin is trying to provide more fuel for the Enlightenment to keep on rolling forward. And he did a good job of it.
Mm-hmm. So as we contemplate the meaning of life and what our purposes are, how do we weave together leisure, which you talked about last week, and work from a couple weeks ago, and Sabbath, and also the meaning of life? How do these pieces all kind of fit together?
They start coming together in this idea of the receptive life. In Luther's day, and I'm going to go back to Luther because he's kind of the grounds things for me, at least, you had two tracks. You had an active life, and you had a contemplative life. So you had two options, the vita activa or the vita contemplativa. And so you could either just get busy and do stuff, which is what most people did, or you could join a monastery or a convent and get out of life and just spend your days worshiping God and contemplating his grandeur and singing the Psalms. And those are your options. And Luther said, no, it's not either one. He didn't exactly express it precisely, but what he taught was, God put you here to do a vocation. God put you here to receive his grace and to live in tune with him. And so I really believe the idea of the vita receptiva, a receptive life, captures this nicely, that we receive from God his gifts and his grace and his mercy, and we get that in our contemplation. We receive that when we worship, in the festival experience of worshiping. And then what does that do? That restores us to be the human God created me to be. And the human God created me to be is one that is in this world, material, physical, tangible, and I go into that world of this physical, tangible world, my vocational responsibilities, and I do what God created me to do. And I receive my vocations, my responsibilities. Like I said, I didn't choose when I was born or who my parents were or what country I was born in. Those are all just givens, but they shape my entire life. And those givens, instead of fighting against them or trying to figure them out, I simply receive what God has established, live into that, and do what God gives me to do. So the receptive life, I think, captures what we receive from God and our forgiveness, and it also captures the idea of receiving my responsibilities as I serve others. And this all comes together in Sabbath, because on Sabbath, what's God doing? Delighting in his creation as human creatures who know our Creator and we delight in him, who know what it means to live in creation and we delight in that, we are able to live in this kind of sweet spot, this Sabbath way of life, which is the receptive way of life, and it all comes together then as Sabbath is the receptive life.
So then, would this be an appropriate prayer in response to that? Grant us hearts and hands to receive with joy all that you have for us?
Absolutely. And then to use those things and to be able to accomplish
faithfully
what I've been given to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly right. Yep.
All right. So let's go back to the third commandment.
All right.
Is it just between me and God?
Yeah, absolutely not. The third commandment is all about taking time to delight, taking time to be in tune. I see, I would argue then that the real creational law intention of God, the design built into the third commandment is, I want you as my creatures to live in ways that are aware and contemplative and enjoying and appreciating and delighting in all that I've created. And I want you to live in tune with me and with one another. So you can't do it alone. You can't keep the Sabbath in isolation. You keep the Sabbath by living with God and with other people. That's why you go to church and you worship. That's why you spend time hanging out with friends and talking. That's why you go for a walk with somebody and just delight in the wonders that God has put all around you. That's Sabbath living.
Now, you bring up a fun little acronym, J-O-Y, Jesus, Others, Yourself. I don't know how often I learned this growing up, but how do we talk about, consider this little acronym in light of everything that we've talked about over the last 20 minutes?
Yeah, I grew up hearing that all the time too. So there's a kind of a standard devotional. Joy comes by Jesus first, then others, and then yourself last. And that's the phenomenal wisdom I was given. And I've now kind of challenged it on just about every front. Because Jesus first implies that somehow I need to give Jesus something. Jesus doesn't need anything I've got to give. He doesn't need my tithe. He doesn't need my hard work. He doesn't need my heart. He doesn't need me. He's God. God's self-sufficient. And so I don't have anything that I can give to God that's going to make his life better. I don't owe him anything besides everything. But see, it's not like I have to earn it. He just gives it. So the idea of Jesus first, sure, we receive what God gives. I get that. But then we come to the others. Yeah, that's really what it's all about. Living my life for the sake of those around me. That's what creatures do. They serve those around them. But then the why part, yourself, well, that doesn't really even enter in. You know, the idea that I have to make sure to have time for myself. No, you live your life for the sake of others. That's what God put you here to do. So the real way to joy is not the J-O-Y acronym, but I would say it's what I would call the down and out life, that God gives me my grace, his grace to me, and then I use that and go serve out to those around me, and I accomplish what God gives me to do in service to others.
Interesting.
I think so.
Boy, I have so many more questions now. But I guess I'll have to save them for our next episode. Anything else on this chapter before we wrap up?
Well,
today?
The receptive life is an awesome way to live because you know who you are. You know what you're here for. I'm God's creature. What am I here for? Serve those around me. And you never have to wonder about where you stand with God because he's shown you in Christ and he gives you that awesome gift, free grace. There it is. I always know it's there. And then I work doing everything that I've been given to do. I'm going to fall short, but yet God's grace is there for me. My identity is never in question, and my purpose is clear cut. I'm here to accomplish what God gives me to do in service to others. I've got a reason to get out of bed and reason to function. It doesn't earn God's favor, but it absolutely serves those around me. It's a pretty cool way to live.
Chapter 5, The Receptive Life, from Day 7 for Work, Rest, or Play, from Concordia Publishing House. Our guest today, the Reverend Dr. Joel Bierman, Professor of Theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure as always.
You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support the Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.